Hey guys, it's Anthony Bandiero here, attorney and senior legal instructor with Blue to Gold Law Enforcement Training, bringing you another webinar. This is a brand new webinar. This is fresh out the box. We may adapt this a little bit to see what your feedback is and so forth, but do me a favor. I have never worked in a correctional facility, okay? Maybe I've been in a correctional facility, but never worked in one, okay? And so give me a little slack. Help me out here. I know that we have so many, smart people on here that know about this topic. They know how things are run. I am encouraging to please share your information. If you have anything to share with me on the mic, we'll get your mic and say, hey, Anthony, this is how we do things. What about this? What about that? I really want your feedback. Okay. Real quick disclaimers, laws and agency SOPs may be more restrictive. Thank you, Marie. So you can definitely help me out here. This is very true with this topic. Now, I got to tell you, I play in my sandbox. I don't play in other people's sandboxes, okay? My sandbox is search and seizure. I am a Fourth Amendment expert, but I'm not an Eighth Amendment expert. And so, there's some things here that may cross over into other amendments. But the thing is, like, a lot of issues that deal with the jails and prison have been addressed by state law. So for example, doing some kind of invasive cavity search, right? That's probably gonna be some state law or certainly some, policies and so forth. So if you have any doubts about what you're doing here, I'm not your attorney. I'm just here trying to, share what I think the law is looking for and maybe some best practices to kind of understand what I think the law is in 2024 and beyond. And finally, this course is legal education, not legal advice. So I got to give some shout out to my good friend, Mike Brave. I depend on Mike all the time to help me out. Mike is absolutely, and I mean this with all sincerity, one of the smartest people I have ever met. Okay. Maybe too smart, because I feel like sometimes I'm talking to Einstein and I'm like, please break it down for a dummy like me. You know, you're up here. I need you kind of down here. But the point I'm bringing up, Mike, is that he really helped me kind of conceptualize some of the legal issues involving jails and prisons and so forth. And he is going to be my call a friend, my phone a friend. If I have a question and, my fellow attendees on here can answer, I'm going to ask if Mike can help me out here. Some of Mike's work is this. Hey, Rick, do me a favor. Are you available, Rick, to put those PDFs in the chat box? So Mike is like me. Mike gives away a lot of his stuff for free. Okay. And, he's not in it for the fame and the money. He's in it to help cops, just like me. And so this is the type of stuff that he does. He does this for free. He gives out these things for free. So the constitutional standard timelines, like, just look at this. This is very, very, oh, you can't upload docs here? Okay. That's okay. Okay. I see, Rick. I see, because No, I got it, Rick. Do me a favor. We want to upload them. Just give me 1 second, guys. Let me pause the video real quick and I can get those downloaded. Hold on 1 second. Just give me 1 second, because he did send them to me. And I guess, Rick, I have to do them. All right. Just give me 1 second, guys. You're going to actually enjoy these. I'm just downloading them to my computer, and then I can save them to the desktop. And this one. And finally, there's 4 of them, so I just got to download all 4. All right. All right, so I got those. Let me resume here and put these in the chat box. Okay. All right, you guys should start seeing those now. So, all right. So please take a look at those. They're really amazing. They're total brain food here. They really do outline Great stuff for you guys, and I appreciate Mike and all his hard work. All right, so this is kind of what I want to do here. I want to talk about some fundamentals, just some basic stuff, prison security, searches directed at prisoners. We're going to talk about, visitors and so forth, and some quick fundamentals. We know that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that the right of privacy in traditional Fourth Amendment terms is fundamentally incompatible with the close and continuous surveillance of inmates and their cells required to ensure institutional security and internal order. We are satisfied that society would insist that the prisoner's expectation of privacy always yield to what must be considered the paramount interest in institutional security. We believe that it is accepted by our society that loss of freedom of choice and privacy are inherent incidents of confinement. You know, it's a beautiful way of saying it, right? It's just the way it is. When you go to prison, don't expect too much privacy. Now, do convicted persons have any rights? Of course they have rights. It's not like the Constitution ends at the doorstep of the prison. And as the Supreme Court said, a prisoner is not wholly stripped of constitutional protections when he's in prison for crime. Does the Fourth Amendment apply to some degree in institutions? According to some courts, that's what they say, Fourth Amendment is, Fourth Amendment that, even though they mostly use, due process and so forth. The Eighth Amendment obviously applies. There's even some First Amendment and certainly some, religious rights in institutions, but it's just not very robust, right? You certainly have a lot less rights than you are a free person. Now, I think a good place to start is with visitors. Visitors enjoy Fourth Amendment protection. They're not incarcerated, right? They're not guilty of a crime. However, they can be searched under certain circumstances in order to maintain institutional security. That just makes sense. It's like when you go to the courthouse, are you searched when you go to the courthouse? Yes. So are you going to be searched when you go to the prison? Yes, right? So as one court said, a prison is a unique institution fraught with sensitive security hazards, not the least of these being smuggling of contraband such as drugs, money, knives, etc. The state has a high security interest in eliminating smuggling into and out of penitentiary. So think about it. The inmates are not allowed to leave, but the visitors are. So we want to make sure as well that we have proper security protocols that they do not leave with contraband. Right. Now, what gives us the right to actually search a visitor? It actually comes down to a couple of doctrines, most notably special needs and Terry versus Ohio. Right. So applying the camera, which I'm going to tell you about that, and Terry balancing approach. So there's two cases here that we want to talk about, camera and Terry. It may be said that the need for security is sufficiently substantial as to justify as reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, some type of screening process for visitors, right? Now, camera is a very famous, if not slightly controversial. Zach, do you think, just Zach is, do you think that camera is a little controversial that, that the government can inspect homes of government recipients and welfare recipients and other people that without a true warrant, just on the fact that they have a legislative scheme. I don't know. I read that case and I'm sure that the academics are, they go crazy over that case. But at the end of the day, this is what happened. Okay. Exactly. I think Zach it created this freestanding reasonable analysis. And what I love about that, what I hate about the case is it says that if you have a legislative scheme, right, we get the government gets to do safety inspections on businesses and so forth. And they're ready for this. The business owners or the homeowners refusal to allow that health or safety inspection. You ready for it? Is the probable cause for the warrant. Right, Zach? That's the probable cause. It's your denial of them entering is the probable cause, right? So, yeah, interesting. Okay, so a health inspector attempted to inspect camera's premises without a warrant, and this guy refused entry. I think his name is Rolando or something, or Roland. It might be Roland Camera. And he got ticketed, you know, because he wasn't allowing these safety inspections in the city of San Francisco. And he got convicted of a, you know, of a petty offense. And ultimately, this goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. And they gave us some, well, as far as cameras concerned, they gave him some good news and some bad news. They said good news is the government can't just tell you, hey, we are going to come and inspect your residence or your business because that's when it's convenient for us, right? Unless it's a highly regulated business like a gun store, a junkyard, maybe a liquor store, maybe. But the point is that they said, so they can't do that. You can't be fined for your refusal, but the government can go get those warrants just because there is a legislative scheme that allows these inspections. So they just did a good old fashioned balancing test and they found that it was reasonable. And as the court balanced the need for effective code enforcement with individual privacy rights, concluding that a warrant process, even for administrative inspections, upholds the Fourth Amendment protections without unduly hindering government functions. Now, why does a health inspection or safety inspection have anything to do with visitors at the prison? You know why? Because it opened the door for these suspicionless searches and or seizures, okay? Now that camera allows a suspicionless search, it opens the door to special needs where the government has these compelling needs to do things without reasonable suspicion or probable cause. The Fourth Amendment provides that no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. Borrowing from a more typical Fourth Amendment case, appellant argues not only that the code enforcement inspection programs must be circumscribed by a warrant procedure, but also that warrants should issue only when the inspector possesses probable cause to believe that a particular dwelling contains violations of the minimum standards prescribed by the code. We disagree. So they are going to allow these warrants with no reasonable suspicion or probable cause. So a lot of people, I think, are not happy about that. But it did introduce, as far as our discussion today, the special needs doctrine. The special needs doctrine is also called the administrative search exception. But generally speaking, at Blue to Gold, we like special needs because that kind of defines really what it is. Another example of special needs is DUI checkpoints, right? A DUI checkpoint, by definition, is everybody stops or every third car stops, but there is no reasonable suspicion as to that particular person. However, there is a special need. We want to get drunk drivers off the street. Not all states agree with that, by the way, right? Texas and I think Idaho do not allow, you know, these kind of checkpoints, but I digress. Here's an example. A defendant and her daughter were stopped at a roadblock near Dick Connor Correctional Center. The stop, conducted by multiple law enforcement agencies and correctional center security, included a drug-sniffing dog. The dog indicated drugs, leading to a consent search of the defendant, who was found in possession of marijuana. You know, are we good, right? Are we good? And the answer is yes. The court upheld the stop and search under the special needs doctrine. We want to prevent this contraband from entering the prison. And just as a little side note, my friend Zach says Michigan is a place that restricts DUI checkpoints, which is where the case came from. DUI versus SITS. I'm sorry, Michigan versus SITS, right? Okay. Or is it SITS versus Michigan? Probably the other way around. The stop of a vehicle at a roadblock. Roadblock on a... Well, it did say consent search, but look, back up. So, Jeremy, that's how they resolved the issue. They got consent. However, the fact that they ran the dog around the car is okay under this, right? And they probably could have searched the car anyway under the motor vehicle exception. So I know that's how they resolved that case, but still we have options, if that makes sense. Okay, cool. The stop of a vehicle at a roadblock on a public thoroughfare is clearly a seizure within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. But the Fourth Amendment prohibits only those seizures that are unreasonable. In determining whether the stop of plaintiff's vehicle was unreasonable, we must evaluate the circumstances of the stop and the relevant interests at stake. So it's a seizure, but we're good to go. Now, the other way to handle these visitors is good old-fashioned Terry versus Ohio, right? So reasonable suspicion requires a moderate chance of illegal activity. It's not a very high standard. But it's a reasonable suspicion. It's a moderate chance that this person, the one that you are going to detain, the one that you're going to pat down is either A, involved in criminal activity, you know, and or possesses weapons and so forth. So it's not a high burden. Now, a sister visited her brother in prison. However, all visitors were required to be skin searched. That's what they said. It's kind of a weird way of putting this, but it's another way of saying, you know, strip searched, right? Before visitation. There was no reasonable suspicion as to her. Can we strip search a visitor on these facts, right? And the answer is absolutely not. I mean, that's crazy, right? You don't get strip searches because you go visit somebody in a prison. And the court said requiring a visitor to submit to a visual cavity search requires at least reasonable suspicion. Now, I want to kind of clarify this. First of all, they paid her a lot of money, okay? They found it was a clear violation. Second of all, I'm not saying, you know, that you can actually conduct the visual cavity search with reasonable suspicion alone. What I'm saying, and please listen to me, you can try to seek that consent to do that search before they visit their friends. I do not believe, based on the case law that I'm reading, and you know, Brave can tell me if I'm wrong, I don't believe that reasonable suspicion alone is a high enough standard to submit to require, to force a visitor to submit to a strip search. I think that you can detain them and try to see if you get criminal activity and maybe make an arrest on probable cause and go from there, or you tell them to leave. Also, don't forget that we actually have several classes that talk about Terry stops and, you know, reasonable suspicion, including this one right here. So either A, attend it live, or B, go to the university, and Rick will put a link in the university. You can go get the class from there so you can know about more about reasonable suspicion. Let's talk about vehicles, right? What about the visitor's vehicles? Can that be searched and so forth? And the answer is yes, with the right facts. So thanks, Rick. So visitor's vehicles may be searched if there is notice that the vehicle could be searched and a potential inmate has access to the vehicle. That is my interpretation of the case law. I do not believe that a visitor's vehicle can be searched, actually, like open the doors and look and so in there and so forth, if there's just no reasonable access by inmates. Because what are we trying to prevent, right? What is the compelling governmental interest to get into the car? We're not looking at general crime control against the visitor. We're trying to instill institutional security, and the car is going to be parked and they're going to leave. Not bomb dogs and drug dogs, of course, those are fine, right, under the Fourth Amendment. Prison visitors sued because their vehicles were randomly searched during visits. Well, the court said that randomly selecting a visitor's vehicles for screening is reasonable to the Fourth Amendment if notice is given and a compelling reason to search. So when these visitors pulled into the parking lot, it said right there that all visitors' vehicles subject to search, and maybe as importantly, the inmates were actually in the parking lot cleaning up trash and doing their field work. So there's your access to the vehicles. We also want to prevent arbitrary searches. So especially with these special needs searches, special needs, you know, it can't be arbitrary. It cannot be capricious. You know, it can't be just off the whim of an official. It has to have some level of standardization, right? Otherwise, it opens the door to prejudice and bias. You know, you may have if you know, you may have an official saying, "Hey, people that dress like that always have drugs. People that look like that always have weapons," and that's not right. So we have to be kind of standardized with this. You know, every prisoner is going to get searched, of course, and so forth. So regardless, searches must not be arbitrary or harassing, right? You know, you would not want to have a prison official, doing an extra search on somebody because they don't like the content of their shirt, or because the person, you know, is, you know, anti-police or something like that, you know, a First Amendment issue. We want to be standard for everybody. The defendant sued the sheriff and jail officials to stop them from demanding a strip search before he could visit an inmate, a procedure not utilized against other visitors and not against him until his arrest on a marijuana charge outside the jail. So this one is kind of weird. Okay. So first of all, again, I don't think that we can strip search visitors, even if it was a matter of routine for everybody. But the second thing is, you know, you can, you know, seek, if you have reasonable suspicion that the person is carrying contraband, you can ask them to submit to a further search. And if they deny it, you know, potentially kick them out, you know, and tell them to leave, right? But the court here is saying, hey, look, there was no connection between his outside marijuana charge and what's kind of going on in the jail. And they said the strip search requirement was overly intrusive given the lack of evidence linking visitors to contraband introduction in the facility, and singling out the accused was improper, for there was no showing of any risk as to him requiring such an intensive search. And I don't know about this part. I don't know, but maybe also there was no as much direct contact with the inmates. Maybe they're behind that glass, et cetera. I don't know. Probably not. Probably he had contact with the person, but these are things to consider when you're going to demand that a visitor submit to a strip search, because again, they have their Fourth Amendment rights. As the court held, a strip search of a visitor is a degrading and embarrassing experience and should be permitted only when other less offensive measures would not render the facility secure. The Fourth Amendment is to the Constitution provides that all citizens shall be secure in their persons from unreasonable searches and seizures. What do you do if they refuse, right? What do you do if they refuse those extra, you know, search parameters? Well, I would love to hear what you guys do, right? But from what I'm seeing, searching jail visitors without probable cause is only justified to prevent contraband weapons from entering. If a visitor refuses a search and leaves, the goal is achieved. Upon return, they should be targeted for even more inspection, because what leaving and not taking, right? Yeah, exactly. And that's what I think you guys are confirming. Like, if they don't consent, but here's the deal though, according to this case, they can be, you know, that is a factor for an increased search the next time they come. Would you guys agree with that? Because not continuing on your visitation is kind of odd, right? Yes, you have the right to leave if you don't want to submit to those procedures, but it is a clue that you may be holding contraband. So what happened in State versus Magan, there was a sign for all visitors that basically said, stop, you are subject to be searched while on these premises, right? Oh, and Joshua says, our visits are done through kiosk. Well, that handles that issue, right? You ain't gonna teleport the drugs to that person. Now, what about this case? So officers had probable cause that a husband was smuggling in contraband to his wife, an inmate. He was told he could be searched and said he would leave, but that request was refused. Do you think we're okay here? Right? What do you think here? Do you think that if we actually have probable cause that he's holding right now, are we going to let him leave? What do you guys think? Matthew says no. What do you guys think? And or why? You guys going to let this guy leave? So Tony says yes, no. Let's no. Okay. So I think the nays are going to have it, right? So if you have probable cause, what can you do? Can't you arrest him? And right, Matt? Right. So here, the officers were allowed to search him with probable cause. Now, correct. And Zach actually says, why aren't we arresting him? So that's actually the way you actually can handle this in one of two ways. Number one, you can just call it an arrest. If you have probable cause, arrest him, right? Search him, incident to that arrest, and you just go from there, right? Oh, but Anthony, what if we are wrong? What if he doesn't have the contraband? Well, I got to tell you, you don't have to be certain for probable cause. You just have to be reasonable and a fair probability. People get arrested, not all the time, but they get arrested sometimes, and the evidence falls apart, and we unarrest them, right? Also, exigency, right? You have exigency. If you have a person in your facility and you have probable cause that they're currently holding drugs right now, most courts are going to probably hold that there was exigent circumstances, even if it was not an arrestable offense. Exactly, Zach. In order to enforce this statute, it was not unreasonable for the prison officials to conduct a search, as in the instant case of defendant's person. This is especially true in view of the fact that a sign was posted informing the public that they were subject to search, except just adds to the problem. It just adds to the reasonableness of that search. Let's look at a video.
Six female New York City correction officers are charged with illegally searching visitors to the Manhattan detention complex. The charges involve strip searches and body cavity searches, which, according to the Department of Correction, are not permitted on visitors. The commissioner of the Department of Investigation said in a statement, quote, stopping contraband before it enters the city's jails is of paramount importance, but it cannot be done at the expense of visitors' dignity, the law, and the correction department's rules. A spokesman for the Correction Officers Benevolent Association came to the officers' defense, noting that more than 50 visitors to the Lower Manhattan facility, known as the Tombs, were arrested last year for attempting to smuggle in heroin, marijuana, cocaine, K2 synthetic, razors, scalpels, and other.
So, you know, hey, look, I just put that video in there because I have no idea what's going on with those corrections officers. But what I like is just to show some context videos, right? That, you know, strip searching a visitor, of course, can cause some issue. Interesting. All right. Curtis says, would it be different if a state agency? No. Usually, Curtis says, would it be different if the state agency ran the jail or is a contract? My view is that the contract, you know, Corrections America is an agent of the government and they have to comply with the Fourth Amendment and so forth. Okay. I think airport body scanners are a great tool in it. Well, if they can find contraband, like, well, they can find firearms and dangerous weapons. I think that that is permissible in a jail facility. In fact, you have court cases out there that actually equate and compare a jail or, you know, and a visitor search like an airport search. So that is of special needs. Airport searches are special needs, and so are jails. All right. Prisoners are subject to searches on their persons and cells, right? Their domicile, you know, their temporary domicile. And it's often the practice to require visitors to the facility to submit to some form of search. We already know that. So the legitimate interest of the government in institutional security and internal order and discipline makes not only reasonable but also necessary that jail authorities have the right to search an inmate both immediately prior to and immediately after allowing him to meet with someone who comes into the jail from outside the jail enclosure and who will leave the jail enclosure to return once again to the outside world after meeting is concluded. How else could the smuggling of weapons, drugs, or other contraband be adequately controlled? Now, we are talking about visual cavity searches here, okay? And they are constitutional under the Fourth Amendment due process and whatever amendment you want to throw in there, right? It's a visual cavity searches are a very, very common thing around America. Now, you have some jails that are getting more sophisticated. I do know that inmates in many jails are actually sitting on a scanner, not like the airport body, maybe like the body scanner, but a little bit more intrusive. And you sit on it and it does like this x-ray thing of seeing if there's any, you know, drugs or contraband in the rectum and so forth, right? So a little bit more intrusive than what an airport scanner would probably be able to find. But that's why you have to sit on it so that the waves actually can be more accurate and so forth. Now, let's first talk about an easy one, a softball one. What about the mail, right? Clearly, you know this, that an inmate, generally speaking, just has no privacy, no legitimate expectation of privacy in their mail unless it's legal mail. So it's very common for, you know, institutions to search that mail. Why no privacy? There's a host of reasons. How about the fact that they'll say the inmate has notice? They know that, you know, when they come in and get the rules, that they know that their mail is going to be searched. They know that if they receive mail, it's going to be searched to make sure there's no escape plans, harassment, security issues. Maybe they gave consent. Maybe a court will throw that in there under the circumstances, implied or express consent, prevent escape plans, threats to outsiders, threats to witnesses, threats to victims, illegal activity. Hey, can you get me an eight ball, you know, by Monday and so forth, right? So it's been around this idea that mail is not protected by the Fourth Amendment has been around since 1919. Their cell, we obviously know, right? Prison cell searches or shakedowns are common in institutional facilities. No reasonable suspicion or notice is required. You know, as long as it's not done to harass a particular person. Those cases do exist, but they're kind of rare. Generally speaking, the institution is doing these shakedowns because of whatever reasons, and they have a reason for doing them. It's not just to target a particular person. Can notes on a legal pad be considered legal mail? Sure. But the problem is it needs some type of protection. In other words, the person, the inmate, needs to identify it as legal mail. But I don't know how you guys in the institutions decipher and will determine what is legal mail and what is not legal mail. It's my understanding that a lot of inmates try to fake it. They try to put legal mail, you know, on their letters, but it's not legal mail. And I would love to know how you guys handle that issue, because I've always been curious about that. As the court has said, this unannounced search may prevent an escape plot or turn up weapons which could have been used in a serious violence. It may also uncover non-dangerous contraband, right? Variously defined in various prisons, but usually including cigarettes, certain books, unauthorized leaflets. This is an older case, right? Or topic. Tobacco, drugs, cash, and a multitude of other materials, which prison officials believe indicative of underlying inmate subculture of violence or immorality. Tobacco, for example, is clearly the currency of most prison societies, and many cigarettes may have been obtained as payment for regulation-breaking acts. All right. Most institutions in Ohio use tablets with email due to the fentanyl people. Okay, that's interesting. You go off what the inmate says, and you can't read it. If they say it's legal mail, you cannot read it, but you can go through it for contraband. I see. Okay, so you kind of, you kind of shake it out a little bit. We scan through them, skim them. These guys hide drugs and kites in their legal mail. Our body cams also show the speed in which we are going through legal mail. So, you know, look, I get it. It's, it's a tough situation, and you know, I'm sure your legal counsel has probably looked at those issues and so forth. Let's look at a classic shakedown. That's a great video, right? Showing the context of these cell searches and why we do them and kind of the contraband that they can find. All right. So searches, prison cells are not to be conducted only pursuant to established policy or upon reasonable suspicion. The courts have said, made it very clear, wholly random searches are essential to effective security in penal institutions. In other words, we can do random ones too, right? Yeah, it really is a great video. And, potentially saved a life there too. I mean, that Shane could have, you know, obviously done a lot of damage in that prison or that jail, right? Hudson conducted a search of Palmer's cell and locker on September 16th, 1981, finding a ripped pillowcase. Now, resulting in charges against Palmer for damaging state property. He's in a lot of trouble. He's in a heap of trouble. Palmer alleges the search was unlawful because they're searching his personal property and so forth. No, this ain't Palmer's home or Hudson's home. I'm sorry, Palmer's home, right? No. The court held that inmates have no reasonable expectation of privacy in their prison cell, period, full stop. As the court said, we hold that society is not prepared to recognize as legitimate any subjective expectation of privacy that a prisoner might have in his prison cell, and that accordingly, the Fourth Amendment prescription against unreasonable searches does not apply within the confines of the prison cell. What about their property? Can we search their property too? Of course we can, right? A prisoner was subjected to a search without a warrant. Officers acting on a tip and without any exigent circumstances compelled the prisoner to open his personal locker, which had been locked with a key in the prisoner's possession. This search led to the discovery of 111 grams of cannabis in the locker. That's a good haul, okay? He wants to complain. Not so fast. The court held that while prisoners are not entirely stripped of constitutional protections, we talked about that, the needs of a prison security can restrict a prisoner's reasonable expectation of privacy. Therefore, a good faith search for contraband conducted by correctional officers, even without the prisoner's consent, of course, does not violate the Fourth Amendment. Searches of inmates searches of inmates property conducted by prison personnel are permissible even if made without probable cause or without reasonable suspicion, provided the such searches are not done cruelly or wantonly and are not accompanied by any intent to harass, humiliate, or intimidate inmates, right? We just want to do it because that's our job. Strip searches. All right, so the court has said that it is not unreasonable to require inmates to remove their clothes to permit visual inspection of the naked body. Such may be warranted and justified as routine under a variety of circumstances. Commonly, what's going to happen is if the inmate is going to be put into gen pop, right, general population, that is, you know, I was talking to my friend, Brave, before, you know, this, and he's like, everybody's going to get a strip search if they're going in general population. But somebody said in Ohio, they're not doing strip searches if you're putting the person in a pod. Can you clarify that for me? That kind of surprised me. What are you doing about the contraband in their crevices and so forth? So just curious if that's what if I took that the right way. But it is obviously a matter of routine, right? Gibson versus Wilkinson is a good case here. Here's what's kind of going on, right? So a prisoner was subjected to a routine visual cavity search after he had contact with laundry contractors with the prison. He sued claiming that these rights were violated. So again, it's routine. He's going to go through that process. If you want to work in the laundry room, and when the contractors come to drop off the sheets and the pillows, whatever it is, when you go back to your pod, you are going to be strip searched. Is that legal? Right? Yes or no? Right? Do you think that is legal? Constitutionally. Yeah. Yeah. I like the postcards from mail. So prison officials alleged conduct and routinely conducting strip and visual cavity searches did not violate the prisoner's Fourth Amendment rights. Searches were justified and related to a legitimate penological interest of prison security, and prisoner offered nothing to rebut such a reasonable justification for the searches, right? So we are not talking about, invasive searches of like medical procedures here. We're just talking about visually, bend over and cough type of deal. And here is an example of what I mean. Not graphic, of course, but you get the point.
She was hiding something. She used to smoke something out of it.
I don't think there's anything in it.
But it looks burnt, like, there's nothing there.
Again, a great video, a great example of why we do what we do to make sure that that does not get introduced into the general population and so forth. Inmate filed a civil rights action against several correctional officers alleging violations related to his conditions of confinement. The case arose when the inmate was subjected to a visual cavity search before being placed in the segregation unit following a disciplinary hearing. Again, guys, this is routine. This is something that jails and prisons do all the time. This did not violate any clearly established right. Jail and prison inmate security is paramount, right? It's paramount. As the court said, performing the strip search without probable cause to believe the inmate was concealing contraband did not violate any established constitutional right of the plaintiff. Visual body cavity search is conducted as a means of preventing prisoners' possession of weapons and contraband, even absent probable cause or reasonable suspicion, have been found reasonable by the Supreme Court. All right. Can multiple daily visual cavity searches become excessive, though? In other words, can we cross a line and become a little arbitrary? And the answer is going to be yes. Parkhill is your case in point, okay? This is the epitome of arbitrary visual cavity searches. Visual cavity searches are usually permitted if there's an articulated reason, you know, we're moving somebody from general population to segregation because of a disciplinary issue. These people often have weapons. They'd like to bring in contraband, right? He's already been a problem child and so forth, right? He's going to be in a jail, in a cell by himself. We want to make sure he's not bringing anything in. Examples include re-entry after working outside, contact with visitors, a spike in contraband. But they can become arbitrary, right? So here's what happened in this case. A state prisoner claimed, right, his constitutional rights were violated due to thrice daily, three times a day. Thrice, I like to do a little Shakespeare here. He was searched, visual cavity searches, three times a day. Now here's the deal. I didn't put this in here. Oh, he was in solitary confinement. The prisoner's complaint stated that since he was held in solitary confinement with no contact with other prisoners, these searches were unreasonable. I think he has a good argument, doesn't he? I mean, he's not in contact with anybody else. He's very restricted in his movements and restricted in where he's at and so forth. And it almost seems, right, that this is done maybe just to punish him, to make him, like, regret going to solitary. And he actually won his case. The court held that the issue of fact as to whether thrice daily visual cavity searches of inmates was reasonably related to the prison's legitimate interest in detecting and deterring contraband under these, especially because he was not in contact with anybody else. And so that's the problem here. As the court said, genuine issue of material fact existed. So we can't get summary judgment on this one. We're going to have to go to court on this one. As to whether the prison's policy of conducting thrice daily body cavity searches was in a secured housing was reasonably related to the prison's interests. So somebody says, what about new arrest strip searches? I think that's very common. I can tell you there's jails out there, many, many jails, right? That before you put the person in general population, even if it's a non-drug offense, that they're going to do a visual cavity search, right? Mike Brave, is that your understanding of the law, right? That even if it's a non-drug offense, exactly. Isn't Vince saying that Florence versus that Florence case? Natalie says, we are told misdemeanors, non-drug offense cannot be strip searched within the sight of the officer. Only felony arrest of drug. Look, that might be a state issue. I can't answer that for you. All I can say is that constitutionally, it is lawful under the U.S. Constitution. Maybe not in your state constitution, right? Maybe not. But so, all right, guys. Does this picture look kind of weird, Rick? I look like a morgue, okay? I look like a morgue. But anyway, maybe I'm dead in that picture. And so, yeah, we might have to get rid of that mortician picture right there. So anyway, it's kind of weird, but we're trying this AI stuff. We do love AI and so forth. But here's the deal, guys. I don't know if you're going to be at ICP in Boston this year, but we have a grand presence there. We have a huge booth. We're going to have a lot of our staff there. I hope that you guys can join us. And I'm going to be speaking twice at ICP. I'm really honored to be doing that. So please let me know if you guys are going to can attend and so forth.